This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
You know, Dwight Eisenhower famously said, anytime I find a problem I don't understand, I make it bigger. And that's a very holistic idea. And so the great thing about the New Economics Institute is that it's taking this sort of overarching approach to the economic shift that's facing us.
This week on Sea Change Radio, we take a special look back at the recent New Economics Institute conference held at New York's Bard College. First, we hear from John Fullerton, a former Wall Street bigwig who became a leading practitioner in impact investment, a theory and practice approach to financial system transformation, which focuses on sustainable and regenerative land use, food, and water. Sea Change Radio co-founder Bill Bowie speaks with Fullerton about what he sees to be the touchstone issues that define the new economy, the roles he sees banks playing in the transition to this new economy, and how he factors social equity and the democratic process into his work. Next, Ben Kurtzman sits down with Senator Tim Wirth at the New Economics Institute conference. The former senator from Colorado, who chose not to run for re-election in 1992, citing frustration with the ever-increasing role of money in politics, talks about the daunting task of moving progressive policies forward in the age of the Citizens United ruling. The president of the United Nations Foundation since its inception in 1998, Wirth talks about what the new economy movement means to him, where he sees it headed, and how surprised he is at the lack of outrage among college-age Americans when it comes to tackling the issue of climate change.
John Fullerton, thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
John, you say that the Capital Institute was born out of three questions. And the first question is, what would an economic system that operates within the physical boundaries of the biosphere, while more equitably serving the needs of people, what would it look like? So what are some of your preliminary answers to this question, and how do you measure and incentivize this economic activity that operates within our limits?
Well, those were questions. I don't pretend to have the answers yet, but I think the starting point has to be some scientifically grounded understanding of what this safe operating space, to use a term that's now quite common, actually is. And there's a very important paper by a researcher named Rockstrom, who wrote an article, I believe, in Nature in 2009. And that was what I think was sort of a preliminary estimate of the, I think it's nine critical biochemical systems or geochemical systems of the planet, and where the current economy operates within those estimates of the safe boundaries. And the alarming news, of course, is that we're already exceeding several of them. The carbon cycle is out of sync. The nitrogen cycle is out of sync, and probably most alarming of all is the rate of loss of the rate of biodiversity loss is running at probably 1,000 times the base rate. And so the first point to understand is that we're not operating within the safe operating space of the planet, and we need some kind of metrics to tell us on what bases, on what issues, and how far we need to shrink the physical impacts of the economy.
And has your research brought about and shown some of these metrics existing, or are these things that we're really needing to sort of build out going forward?
Yeah, I think we're at the stage where we're still debating and arguing about whether or not there are boundaries. I would say the conventional economics understanding is that, markets will price and substitute goods for other goods, and that this isn't really a problem. And so, unfortunately, we're not actually trying to get to solutions to what I see as the problem, and many scientists see as the problem. We're really just in a debate about whether a problem exists. And that's been going on now for however many years I've been thinking about this. So,
And so really what I'm hearing you say is the first order of business is really to get consensus in the economic community, in the business community, in the investment community, that a problem exists.
Right.
How do you go about doing that? You know, how do you raise awareness? How do you communicate? How do you convince?
Another hard question. Well, you yourself are familiar with Dana Meadows' famous paper, How to Change a System, and I've sort of been following that in our own strategy at Capital Institute, and probably the most important thing is to try to reframe the paradigm within which the system exists. And so I spend a lot of time writing about and giving talks about the inconsistencies of the assumption of exponential material growth on a finite planet, along with a lot of other people. I hope my voice adds to that chorus. Coming from a Wall Street background, perhaps I have a slightly different voice than someone coming out of the environmental movement. But I think collectively, we just need to keep pointing out the inconsistencies with the core assumptions. And at the same time, that reality is becoming more and more apparent in everyone's minds. And so in this country, we still debate about whether climate change is real. But now that, you know, people are observing the weather, it's getting harder and harder to live in denial that something is changing. And that's just on the climate issue. That's just the carbon issue. There's, as I mentioned earlier, many other issues that we need to address, from water to biodiversity to the nitrogen cycle.
And you mentioned that you're coming out of Wall Street, and you were a banker at JP Morgan for a long time.
Right.
What role can banks play in the transition to a new economy, and particularly what's needed to get away from the current activities of banks, and particularly the too big to fail banks, that are keeping us from making a transition to a new economy?
There's really two parts to the challenge. The first is we need to rein in and control the speculative excess that has become the core of the too big to fail banking business. And that's easier said than done, particularly with a political system that's largely captured by the financial interests. But at its core, we as a culture, not just the banks, but as a culture, I believe, have lost sight of the distinction between real investment and financial speculation. And even you and my 401k mutual fund, managed by any of the major mutual fund management companies, are typically churning stocks and bonds several times a year. And that is essentially, you know, a form of financial speculation in financial securities. And we call that investment. That's an important activity for someone to do, which is to deploy our savings into securities. But what we need to focus on is the real investment decisions that are made by corporations, by governments, and by individuals. And when I say real investment, I mean investment in building things. And I use the phrase, real investment is the bridge to the future economy. And so getting back to your question, the role the banks can play, or the banks need to play, you know, banks provide a critical vehicle to transform savings into real investment. And so the loans that banks choose to make and the loans that banks choose not to make are critical in this transition. And so we need to get the conversation with the banks around, what are you lending toward, what are you not lending toward, rather than why are you speculating in this credit default swap and losing $2 billion here and losing $2 billion there, and how do we possibly regulate it? So it's a big distraction from the conversation we really need to be having with the entire banking system, as well as with the investment process itself of what corporations choose to invest in and not invest in, and what governments choose to invest in and not invest in.
And I'm assuming that might also include what we were talking about in the first question, which is investing in goods or services that operate within limits, compared to investing in, even if it's a hard good or hard service, if it's not operating within our limits, then that's, you know, that's another layer of complexity.
Yeah, one of my colleagues, Peter Brown, uses a phrase called entropic thrift. And I don't know if he coined the term, but it's an important idea, which is that, you know, just take energy. Energy is at the core of a lot of this, of course. And if we recognize that we are exceeding the safe operating space of the planet, and therefore we're using up too much entropy, we're using up too much energy and converting energy from usable energy to not usable energy, then every time we choose to build something that uses energy, you know, in an ideal world, there should be some democratic process to determine whether that's a good use of that entropy. And so investing in some technology that converts us from a high fossil fuel energy system to a low or zero fossil fuel energy system ideally is a good use of entropy. It still requires entropy to do that, but isn't that a better investment than, for example, building an indoor ski resort, literally, in the Meadowlands in New Jersey, or worse, in the desert of Abu Dhabi? Somehow we need to come together and make choices about what we're going to invest in if we acknowledge that we're in an entropy-scarce world.
Meet me in the middle of the day, let me hear you say everything's okay. Bring me southern kisses from your room. Meet me in the middle of the night, let me hear you say everything's alright. Let me smell the moon and your perfume. Oh, gods and years will rise and fall, there's always something more. It's lost in talk, I waste my time, it's all been said before. While further down behind the masquerade, the tears are there. I don't ask for all that much, I just want someone to care.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. You're listening to Bill Bowie interviewing John Fullerton at the recent New Economics Institute conference.
One of the things that you say in your mission for the Capital Institute is creating an equitable on having equity in the equation. So how do you factor in issues like democratic decision-making and social equity into the work that you do?
So I think I don't have great answers for this is the first point. I think the second point is, particularly within the financial community, there's this notion that we're still in a world of individualism and a belief that my freedom includes my freedom to choose what to do with my capital. And whether I'm a corporate CEO or an individual investor or an individual billionaire investor, the notion that my investment decisions are someone's business other than my own is radical. And yet those investment decisions, whether they're in speculating in credit default swaps or building indoor ski resorts on the desert or building wind farms, have public implications and equity implications on society as a whole. And so we're in this transition where we need to kind of ask some really basic core questions, like what does freedom, everyone agrees that you can't go in a movie theater and shout fire. And now I would argue in a resource constrained world, finite planet, there are many more examples of screaming fire in the movie theater that we haven't really processed yet are analogous to screaming fire in a movie theater. So just like if you're stranded in a lifeboat with two buckets of water, it matters whether you spill water and slosh it over the side and choose to wash your face. It matters to everyone else in the lifeboat. We need to begin to think about our natural resources and our limited waste sinks in a similar way. And it will change the nature of where the lines on individual freedom start and stop. And I think getting that framework is the beginning point of then having a conversation about how to generate equitable outcomes. What does equitable mean? Who decides what equitable is? But we're not even at the point of understanding that we need to address the question, I think.
Another instance of that. Well, then I'll shoot back another easy question then.
Great.
For you. You write a lot about resilience,
right,
on your blog on the Capital Institute, The Future of Finance. And I've just been interacting with a scenario expert, Barbara Heinzen, who defines resilience in two ways. Mm. There's resilience where it's the ability to return to the status quo, but then there's the resilience that's the ability to adjust to a new reality. How do these notions fit into your thinking about the role of resilience in creating a new economy, a new resilient economy?
We actually just had a very interesting conversation that was triggered by one of my blogs, and in particular a comment that Bill Reese, who's the ecologist that coined the term ecological footprint, made, and he called his response the double-edged sword of resilience. And the idea is that if we have a system that is sort of locked into driving us off the cliff, to use a simple analogy, then making that system more resilient isn't necessarily a good thing. And in fact, I would argue we do have in a sense, a very resilient financial system, but it's only resilient because it's been underwritten by the Federal Reserve and the taxpayers to hold it from collapsing or moving into a different state of equilibrium. And that's not the kind of resiliency we need. What we need is a resiliency. We need to get the system into what is probably a better term, a regenerative state, where the whole economy operates the way nature does, which is to be in a continuously regenerating, improving state. And I say that regenerating both at the natural capital, you know, the biocapacity needs to be where it's been depleted, it needs to be restored, and it needs to be allowed to do its normal, natural, regenerative action. That's the basis of our human civilization, is our biocapacity. And similarly, in the social capital realm, we need an economy that enables a regenerative social capital. So people have gainful employment, people have an ability to create financial security for themselves, people have the ability to get an education and improve their selves, people have an opportunity to enjoy culture and the arts. All of these things are regenerative in nature. And so we need an economic system that fosters and enables that kind of regeneration. And once that system is in place, then it needs to be resilient. But it's a complicated question when you acknowledge that we're not in a regenerative state, you know, whether you want it to be resilient or not. And you know, this gets right to the debate, should we have bailed out the banking system? Now, I could argue both sides of that argument. I come out in the belief that had the government not intervened to protect the banks, the fallout for the real economy and for, you know, society as a whole would have been unacceptable. And so that it probably was the right decision to step in and make the system more resilient through government intervention. I would differ strongly in how we did that and the quid pro quo for what we did for the banks, but I don't think it would have been a good decision just to let the banking system collapse. But having said that, we need a system now that is, you know, when I say more resilient, I mean, you know, less concentrated, less centralized, more place-based, more connected to the real economy, more buffers to prohibit, you know, or to absorb shocks. Equity is the classic buffer in the banking system, but there are plenty other ways to create buffers so that, you know, a problem in one bank doesn't permeate the entire system. So we need to think, you know, use system science and our understanding of complexity science to compare sustainable natural systems or complex systems to the financial system we have and adjust the architecture accordingly.
So final question, yeah. What role do you see the New Economics Institute conference playing in this incredibly complex transition that you've just been describing? You know, so what kind of supports are needed and what kind of role can be played?
Well, I'm very excited about the role for the New Economics Institute. There is now an accepted space called the New Economy Space. And I think what the New Economics Institute is already doing and will continue to do is to sort of serve as the large tent and the convener of multiple ideas that are on multiple different dimensions of this problem. And it's important for us to take a holistic look at this problem. And, you know, Dwight Eisenhower famously said, anytime I find a problem I don't understand, I make it bigger. And that's a very holistic idea. And so the great thing about the New Economics Institute is that it's taking this sort of overarching approach to the economic shift that's facing us. And Capital Institute, as a close partner with them, sort of fills the financial system niche. But there are many other issues, like how do we think about the commons? How do we think about currencies? What's the proper goal of the economic system, alternatives to GDP? These are all critical pieces of one whole challenge, which is the challenge of the transition to a new economy. And there really isn't an organization or an institution around that has gathered really the, you know, the leading thinkers and practitioners all driving toward this new economy objective. So I'm very optimistic for the New Economics Institute's role in this in the future.
Well, John Fullerton, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. Next, we listen to Ben Kurtzman talking with Senator Tim Wirth at the New Economics Institute conference.
So what are some of the exciting examples of government spurring the new economy movement at the local and the national and the global level?
What are some of the examples of what?
Of government spurring the new economy movement locally, nationally, globally.
I think people here at the new economy movement believe that this is something that's brand new. Well, it's not. You know, developing a new economy is something that we have done a number of times in the United States. We've done it over and over and over again, and the government has been involved and been a very constructive partner. One has to think about sort of go back in phases to the reform era at the turn of the 19th to the 20th century. Government set up a whole new set of rules. Franklin Roosevelt established a whole new set of rules. The government during the Civil War made all kinds of investments, the State and Land Grant University Act, the railroads, you know, and one Homestead Act, one act after another that were government investments that changed the economy and gave people a greater sense of involvement and equity. And government has to be that kind of a partner today.
So what roles are the UN Foundation and various UN agencies playing in the new economy movement?
I think the UN is struggling to understand this. The UN is the scorekeeper. It keeps the basic measures of economic performance, of population activities, of, you know, one thing after another. The UN is the totes everything up. Well, what does the UN tote up? Interestingly enough, the General Assembly, only about a month ago, had a session on the new economy. The UN is not known as a cutting-edge institution, and I was very surprised that suddenly on the calendar of the General Assembly was a full-day session on what the new economy had to mean. What was the green economy? Was this green jobs, green economy? What was meant by this? People are really struggling to figure this out. My guess is that Copenhagen had a lot to do with this in the UN system, that world leaders came together and they saw, preparing for Copenhagen, that things just weren't working anymore and that the environmental damage was extraordinary, that the economic model didn't work any longer. And governments began at the highest level, because there were a lot of heads of state in Copenhagen, that began to filter down to, you know, their foreign ministries and maybe to their finance ministries and certainly to their environmental ministries. And that's what we began to see at the UN. So it's starting to bubble air, and we've got to figure out how to keep that going. Rio might help for that a little bit. I think maybe more importantly will be the very specific steps that the UN can take. The UN is a norm setter. The UN is not an operating entity at its best. The UN at its best is a norm setter. The world agrees to certain norms, to certain approaches. So when this gets into that norm-setting structure at the UN, that will help globally.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about how the new economy movement can expand. How can it become a mass movement?
The new economy movement can grow dramatically when two things happen. One, you begin to get real articulated demands from the grassroots, and both Gus Speth and Bill McKibben talked about that last night. People have to be unafraid to confront the establishment, not to say, oh, we're just going to be incremental and go along with others, but really to confront from the left. And I think that has to be done. Goodness knows we've all been hammered thoroughly from the right by people confronting the system for the right, and the a very good example of that is the Tea Party, confronting from the right and being very successful. It's a small portion of the population, but they're being very successful. So that's one step that has to be taken, and that's beginning a little bit. The surrounding the White House on the Keystone Pipeline is probably a good example of that. The other thing that has to be done is that you have to have a government changing the rules, because the rules make an enormous amount of difference. Whether we go back to the historic discussion of changing gross domestic product to have some other kind of an index that gets used, that's a changing of the rules. Changing the rules is how do we measure carbon, and then how do we price carbon. The government has to do this sort of thing. EPA has to do this sort of thing, and that takes you back to political leadership, and then ultimately that takes you back to campaign finance reform. Because we're never going to get the government to play the role that it wants to play, needs to play, rather, unless we get campaign finance reform. Because the power of the ownership of government by a few large corporations and very wealthy individuals is now getting totally out of control, but the government is brought to a halt as a result.
Yeah, shifting gears a little bit from wealthy individuals, could you talk a little bit about the role of the younger generation, 20-somethings and 30-somethings, in the new economy movement?
I've been surprised that there hasn't been a greater outrage among young people across the country about climate change. What McKibben's doing in 350.com is terrific, but maybe I'm missing it. But I don't yet see this bubbling up with the kind of aggressive approach that has to be taken. It's their future, much more than my generation's. It's my grandchildren's future. They're a little bit young for this, but it's young people, and it's college campuses, and it's professors and so on that have to be on the organizing edge. So what's happening? I think we have to understand more about the culture of what's going on college campuses today, and I'm a little distant from that now. I used to be a political organizer and did a lot of that, but I haven't done that for 20 years. So I'd want to know pretty rapidly a lot more about what's going on college campuses and why hasn't there been a spark that came from the horrors of the future of climate change. I don't get it. Maybe there's more out there than I think, but McKibben's doing a great job, but where else is this happening?
So what's impressed you the most about what you've seen at this conference here at Bard College? What are some of your takeaways?
I think the very impressive sense of creating a very broad coalition. This is not going to happen with good government people or economics people or environment people or women's groups or whatever it may be. They've all got to come together under a broad umbrella. And that has always been the case when big changes came about in the United States. The reform era all came together under a populist banner. And there were lots of different interests, whether those were farm interests or child labor interests or urban interests or whatever. So that same sort of thing has to happen here. And the more that's said, the more people get a sense of that, I think the better we're going to be. We can learn a lot from American history, and we ought to do so and really pay attention to that.
Sway the future to the past and find what will
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis and additional music by Alex Wise. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.